50 years ago now, a woman told Bruce Grayson something he says challenged what he thought he knew about the brain and the mind. This was the focus of his study, the brain. Grayson was in medical school, just starting his training as a psychiatrist.
One of my first days on call there, I was asked to see a patient in the emergency room who had overdosed, whose name was Holly. I was in the cafeteria eating dinner when it happened, and the pager on my belt startled me when it went off, and I dropped my fork and accidentally spilled some spaghetti sauce on my tie. So I just put on a white lab coat so no one would see that. And I went down to the emergency room to see the patient, and she was completely unconscious. I could not arouse her no matter what I did. But her roommate was waiting down the hall to speak with me in another room. So I went down the hall and talked to the roommate for about 15, 20 minutes about what had been going on in the patient's life. And it was a very hot Virginia evening, and I unbuttoned my lab coat so I wouldn't sweat so much. This was before the days of air conditioning. And I accidentally exposed the stain on my tie. And I went back to see the patient, and she was still unconscious. When I went there the next morning, she was barely awake, still very drowsy. And I started to introduce myself, and she stopped me and said, "I know who you are. I remember you from last night." Well, that kind of surprised me because I thought she was totally out of it the night before. So I said something like that to her. I said, "No, I'm surprised. I thought you were unconscious when I saw you last night." And then she stared at me and said, "Not in my room. I saw you talking to my roommate down the hall." That just blew me away. I didn't know what she was talking about. The only way she could have known that was if she had left her body and followed me down the hall. And as far as I could tell, I was my body. How can you leave it? She sensed my confusion and then went on to tell me about the conversation I had with her roommate, what questions I asked, what the answers were, where we were sitting, what the room looked like. And finally, she said, "And you had a striped tie on with a red stain on it." That just stunned me. But I didn't have time to deal with my confusion. I was there to try to help her. So I tried to stuff my feelings away and just talk with her about her thoughts about suicide, what was going on with the overdose and so forth, and arrange for her to be transferred to the psychiatric unit when she had sufficiently recovered. I kind of pushed it out of my mind and tried not to think about it. And it wasn't until about 5 years later that a colleague of mine at the University of Virginia, Raymond Moody, wrote a book called Life After Life, in which he gave us the term near-death experience and described what they were like. And that was my first indication that this story this patient had told me was not just one account from a psychiatric patient, but was part of a phenomenon that many people were experiencing around the world. Being a scientist, I thought, well, I need to try to understand this. You don't run away from things you don't understand, you run towards them. So I started collecting other cases and trying to make sense out of them. And here I am, a half century later, still trying to make sense out of them.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's that little bit of spaghetti sauce that makes this story hard to work out. How did a woman who was supposedly unconscious and down the hall spot the sauce on Grayson's tie? And there are all kinds of stories like this in his collection of near-death experiences that he's trying to make sense of, where people in other places or under anesthesia are seeing things or hearing things that just cannot be explained. So are they features of the mind, not the brain, the mind, assuming one is separate from the other? Or is there a material explanation? Maybe these experiences are not evidence of an afterlife or another dimension. They're just chemical or electrical impulses in the brain. There's a defense mechanism brought on by trauma or stress. Bruce Grayson is joining us today to talk about what these near-death experiences tell us about how this all works, what kinds of patterns or themes they follow, and how they change the people experiencing them. Grayson's book is called After.
This is not a topic back in the 1970s, 1980s that many people had heard about, and most of my colleagues in the medical school had not heard about these things, and like I myself, didn't know what to make of them, and kind of thought they were just ramblings of a crazy patient and not to be paid attention to. So I had a lot of colleagues who wished I would stop looking into these strange things and just go back to mainstream medical science. There was a risk that pursuing this material would hurt my chances of having a successful career and getting promoted. But I felt that it would have been intellectually dishonest to pretend it didn't happen, to pretend that I didn't have this experience with Holly and I hadn't encountered other people who had even more profound experiences than that. It would have been sort of abandoning my scientific principles to act as if these things didn't really occur.
Dr. Grayson, one of the things you also mentioned, speaking of intellectual honesty, you say intellectual honesty demands that you avoid taking sides in this debate. Just lay out the debate for us, if you would. There's a question of whether or not this is just these near-death experiences are just some sort of chemical reaction going on in the brain.
Right.
Or in fact, if it's the functioning of a mind, the mind, independent of the physiology somehow of the brain. Would you just talk a little bit about that, if you would, and explain why it is you say you have to, through intellectual honesty, avoid taking sides.
Right. Well, I think there's a good case to be made for the near-death experience being at least partly a physiological event. Mm-hmm. They usually don't happen out of the blue. They happen because something happens in the body, particularly in the brain, to stop its normal functioning. And it's plausible to think that something going on in the brain is causing the experience, either a lack of oxygen to the brain or some chemicals produced in the brain that are creating this phenomenon. But it appears to be more than just that. We usually are taught that the mind is what the brain does and all our thoughts are created by the brain. Right. And yet in near-death experiences and some other experiences as well, the brain seems to be not functioning as it should, sometimes not functioning at all, and yet the mind seems to be functioning better than ever. People who have near-death experiences say their thoughts were more vivid and more logical than ever. Their perceptions were more vivid than ever. They lay down memories that don't fade over time, and yet the brain does not seem to be capable at that time of producing those thoughts. So it strongly suggests that there's something else going on besides just the physical workings of the brain. Now, people who want to believe in materialism say, well, if there's this mind that's not material, where is it? And how does it interact with the physical brain? And I have no idea what the answer to those questions are. I don't know where it is. I don't know how it interacts with the brain. However, if you assume that the brain creates our thoughts and feelings, we have no explanation for that either. We have no idea how a chemical or electrical process in the brain can create a thought or a feeling or a perception or create a memory. Mm-hmm. We've been studying that for hundreds of years and have not the slightest hint of an idea. So we don't really know what creates or causes our thoughts and our feelings. People often argue whether a near-death experience is a physical event or a spiritual or psychological event. And I don't think either one by itself is the answer. And let me give you an analogy. The desk I'm sitting at now could be described in physical terms as it's made out of wood. Actually, it's teak and it's rectangular. And that's an accurate description of my desk, but it's not a complete one. I could also say that this desk was my grandfather's, and it's part of the legacy he left for me, and it's a symbol to me of my bond with him. And that's an accurate description of my desk, but not a complete one. To understand my desk, you need both the physical description and the psycho-spiritual description. And I think that's true of near-death experiences as well. You can't just look at the physical aspects of what's going on in the brain and understand near-death experiences. And you can't also just look at the, quote, spiritual portion of the NDE, the near-death experience, and ignore the brain and think you understand it that way either. I think you need both to understand a near-death experience.
I think, of course, and I think that maybe you can understand why I and a lot of other people who are encountering these stories and reading your book are going to have a difficult time getting past the spaghetti stain moment or any number of those moments that are just like that, that it seems just, in a material sense, physically impossible for Holly to have seen. How could she have done that? How could she have seen that spaghetti stain on your tie? Or, again, this litany of these similar kinds of experiences, right, where people, it seemed impossible for them to know that a particular doctor who was working on them in surgery was behaving a certain way. That story and stories like that play out, or seeing events or seeing people. I mean, people are going to get stuck on that, and I'm wondering how you sort of give us some guidance to move past it so we can think more deeply about this story.
Sure, sure. Well, in a way, it's unfortunate that Holly was my first experience, because I wasn't of a mindset then to be able to investigate it accurately or properly. I was totally stymied by it. I didn't know what questions to ask. I don't think it's possible for her to have seen me and heard me doing those things from a physiological perspective.
Yeah.
But it's conceivable. I don't think it's likely, but it's conceivable that someone else could have told her those things, that somehow her roommate who knew about these things could have contacted her, although that really wouldn't be possible since she was in the intensive care unit. But I wasn't able at the time to investigate it fully as I would now. However, since then, as you mentioned, I've encountered many other examples of people who we know were totally unconscious at the time they saw and heard things that they describe accurately, things that could not have been guessed, things that were very unusual. We also have examples of people who encountered deceased loved ones or deceased individuals in their near-death experience. Now, that's easy to explain away as being expectation and wishful thinking.
Yeah.
But we have lots of cases now where there are people who, in their near-death experience, encountered a deceased individual who was not known at the time to have died. And you can't dismiss that as wishful thinking or expectation if they didn't know that they had died. I've investigated several of these cases myself, but they go back in history. Pliny the Elder wrote about a case like this in the first century. So it's not a new phenomenon, and it's something that we just can't explain away.
Bruce Grayson. He's a physician and a professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral medicine at the University of Virginia. His new book is After: A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
To cap the first season of State Street, we'll answer this question for you. How the heck can you be more involved in the political process? I'm Emily Means.
And I'm Sonia Hudson. Join us to hear some of the easiest and most impactful ways to become more involved in local politics and make a difference in your community.
Find State Street wherever you listen to podcasts or go to KUER.org/State Street.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to make sense of near-death experiences. The academic psychiatrist Dr. Bruce Grayson has been collecting these stories over decades of people who almost died, and at the scenes of an accident or on a hospital gurney, they say they left their body or were transported to some other dimension or place where they saw loved ones in some cases, God in some. In many of the stories, they couldn't quite express what they saw, just that it was peaceful and full of love. In a new book, Grayson explains the patterns and characteristics of these experiences, how time slows down, how their life passes before them, and how it always changes everything. Grayson's book is called After. Let's get to some of these stories. I wanted to talk about a man named Henry. Mm. You tell this story early on. Henry has an experience of trying to end his life. Could you just tell us the story about Henry, if you could? And I want to ask a few things about it.
Sure.
I think it reveals a few things about how you think about this.
Yeah. This was also a patient of mine who I encountered before I had known about near-death experiences. It was only a few months after I had encountered Holly. And he had he was a middle-aged man who lived on a farm with his parents. His father had died eventually, and he was there living alone with his mother at the time. And she got very sick, and he was kind of charged with trying to take care of her and take care of the farm. At one point, she finally had to be hospitalized with severe pneumonia. And when he brought her to the hospital, she kind of begged him not to leave her alone there. But since he had to go back and take care of the farm, he did and came back in the morning. And in fact, she had died overnight. And he was just devastated. And for months, he just wandered around the farm and started drinking more and more and more, and finally decided he couldn't live without his parents. So he got his hunting rifle and drove to the cemetery where his parents were buried and lay down on the grave. And after sitting there for several hours thinking about things, he shot himself. He put the rifle down with pointing at his chin and pulled the trigger with his thumb and blew off the right side of his head. By some stroke of luck, he missed his brain, but his right jaw was completely taken away. And he was admitted to the hospital. And when I saw him, he was still on the plastic surgery ward, getting his face reconstructed. He was later transferred to psychiatry, where I was his physician. And to my surprise, he was not at all sad or suicidal when I interviewed him. And what he told me was that he still missed his parents very much, but that as soon as he shot himself, he was transported from the cemetery to some other realm, a beautiful realm where he saw his parents. And at first they seemed happy to see him. They greeted him. And then his mother had a sad expression on her face and said, "Oh, Henry, now look what you've done." And then the experience ended for him, and he was back in the cemetery with blood pouring out of him. And what he said was that even though he still missed his parents, he was relieved to know that they were in some other world and together, and he felt good about where they were and was no longer sad for them and felt that someday he would be rejoining them. And that made him not only less suicidal, but he tended to value life more. And he was eager to start talking to other patients who had attempted suicide and encourage them to reengage with life as well. At the time, as I said, I didn't know anything about near-death experiences, so I didn't have any context for what he was telling me.
Yeah.
So I assumed this was all a hallucination that came from his grieving. And again, wishful thinking and expectation. He saw his parents because he wanted to, so he imagined seeing them there. And I didn't really make anything other than that out of the experience of the time.
Let's talk about one of the dynamics that you've learned. When it seems like this is a pattern in these near-death experiences, and that is it seems like remarkable clarity of the experience that's expressed by most of these people who have these experiences.
Right.
Tell
right.
the story of Bill the firefighter, if you would, because I think he's a good example of this kind of clarity.
This is a fellow who's actually in the Air Force, and he was one of the firefighters there, and a plane had exploded on the runway. And he was called to go there and help put out the fire, part of a team that was doing that. And he was starting to do that, and another part of the plane exploded, and he was caught in the explosion and thrown, I forget how long, but thrown quite a bit in the air and basically knocked unconscious. he was conscious enough to be able to hear what was going on, although he couldn't really see what was going on. And he saw the other firefighters and paramedics going over the people who had been caught in the explosion and taking those who could be saved and rushing off with them. They didn't bother with him because they thought he was already dead. He wasn't sure who that dead person was. He actually was watching all this from some out-of-body perspective, looking down on the scene. And he was trying to get their attention, trying to call them by name to get their attention to help him. And, of course, they didn't hear him. And then at one point he realized that quote, dead body on the ground was actually him because he recognized some features of it.
Yeah.
But during that time, his perceptions, his thinking process were at least as clear as normal and probably clearer than normal, he says. He was able to see and hear things as if he was still in the body. In fact, more clear than usual. And this is something we hear again and again from near-death experiencers, that when they were out of the body, their ability to see things and to hear things was greater than ever. Some say they hear sounds they had never heard before. They see colors they had never seen on Earth. And their thinking was faster than ever. And you hear this again and again and again from people who've had near-death experiences, that without the restrictions of the brain and the body, your consciousness really expands and you can see and hear things and feel things much more vividly than ever.
What does that tell us then about, I mean, because one of the characteristics, it seems, in these experiences was the fact that even though their actual physical brains were impaired during these particular moments, that they were able to have this sort of objective experience, said right. That there was a difference, seemed to show there's a difference between the physical, physiological process of the brain and whatever it is we mean by the mind, that these were separate kinds of experiences. Am I getting that right?
That's right. That's exactly how they themselves experience it. The idea that we have a mind that is not created by the brain, but kind of filtered by the brain, is not a new idea at all. Hippocrates wrote about this 2,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. He called the brain the interpreter of the mind. And physician Larry Dossey says now that we are conscious not because of the brain, but in spite of the brain. And one of the ways people sometimes explain this is to think of the brain as a filter, kind of like a television set receives signals from outside and filters them so that you can watch one. If there are hundreds of television stations being broadcast to your TV set all the time, if you tried to listen to them all or watch them all, you wouldn't understand any of it. So the TV set allows you to filter out all those channels but the one you want to listen to and lets that one come through so then you can watch it and appreciate it. And the idea is that the brain does the same type of thing. There's all this stimulation that's accessible to consciousness when you're out of the body, but that it's filtered out by the brain so that only a small portion of it gets through to you when you're in the body.
You tell this really interesting story. There's this Swiss geology professor named Ooh. Albert Heim,
yes.
who has this experience when he's climbing in the Alps when he's younger. Falling basically from a cliff. And he talks about the experience as time slowing down, this
right.
again, this sense of real clarity, hearing an actual dull thud of his body and then realizing that objectively that the fall is over. To talk a little bit about this, what's really interesting is Albert Einstein sort of comes into this story
yes.
a little bit about this question of how we – because this is so fascinating, the idea of how time in moments of crisis or possibly near-death experiences seems to slow down, that
right,
we
yeah.
seem to have a clarity of moment that seems materially impossible almost.
Right, right. Well – most near-death experiences do say that time slowed down tremendously in the near-death experience, and some say that it ceased to exist entirely.
Yeah.
But Heim was in his 20s, I believe, when he had this accident. He was climbing the Alps, and he slipped and fell. And he was just free falling down the mountainside. And he had a very vivid experience. He left his body, and he watched his body from an out-of-body perspective, repeatedly crashing against the rocky crags, getting bloodier and bloodier. And he felt nothing at all of that pain. And during this time, he said, time slowed down for him, and his thoughts speeded up. He had a total life review in which he saw his entire life before him, re-experienced it in exquisite detail. And he says when he wrote about this, it's not like I'm telling it to you now in just outline form, but it was every minute detail what came available to me. And he had time as he was falling, which must have taken just a few seconds, to think about how he would need to twist around in midair so he would land in a snowbank rather than on the rocks and hopefully survive, whether he should take his glasses off so he didn't let them shatter and hurt his eyes, whether he should hold on to his walking stick or not. He had time to think about the lecture he was supposed to give a few days later, about his loved ones who would be left behind. And all these thoughts came to him in the few seconds as he was falling down the cliff. Where Einstein came in with this, Haim was so astounded by this experience that he started talking about it to other climbers.
Right.
And he quickly found 30 other cases just like his that he published in the yearbook of the Swiss Alpine Club in 1892. He was so impressed by this experience that he started talking about it to his students in his geology classes. And about 10 years later, he had a student who was then the teenaged Albert Einstein at the Zurich Polytechnic Institute. And Einstein took not one but two classes in geology from Haim, in which he heard Haim say that the faster he fell, the faster he moved, the slower time got, the more time expanded. And years later, Einstein wrote the theory of relativity, in which he speculated that the faster we go, the slower time gets. Now, we know that Einstein knew about this case because he then, when Haim died, wrote to Haim's son and told him how wonderful he thought that experience was. But he never said, in writing at least, that Haim's experience affected his thinking about the theory of relativity. But we can certainly wonder about that.
Bruce Grayson, his book is After. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bruce Grayson's new book about near-death experiences is packed with these really interesting questions, like, does consciousness survive physical death? Is the mind different from the brain? And I guess the obvious one, is there an afterlife? Grayson looks for answers in the book, and he has dozens and dozens of these stories he's collected over the years. One thing he can say is that almost all of the experiences changed people's lives. The book is called After. Well, let's talk about one of the characteristics of these near-death experiences that you explore in the book, and that is the life review.
Yes.
You often hear people who say, I saw my life just zip right in front of me. It all played out in front of me. But this is sort of an element. This is part of a pattern, people being able to look at their life, however we can explain that, in an objective kind of way, I guess.
Right. They often feel as if they're re-experiencing every event of their life in minute detail. And one of the surprising things to me was that in about a third of these cases of people who report a life review, They report re-experiencing the events not only from their own perspective, but from the viewpoint of other people involved in the events.
Right.
And one of the examples I give in the book is a fellow named Tom, who in his 30s was working underneath a truck in his driveway, and the truck fell and crashed, crushing his chest.
Yeah.
And he had a near-death experience at that point, in which, among other things, he had a very vivid life review in which he experienced the event not only through his own eyes, but through someone else's as well.
His aunt Gay, right? Yeah.
Yes, yes. The one that stuck with me most was where he was a teenager driving his truck, and a drunk man wandered out in front of his truck. So he jammed on the brakes to avoid hitting him and just was furious. So he rolled down the window and started yelling at the man. And the man, being intoxicated, unfortunately reached his hand in the window and slapped Tom across the face. And that was too much for this hot-headed teenager. So he came out of the car, out of the truck, and started beating the man up and left him basically a bloody mass in the median strip. Well, when he had his life review in his mid-30s, he re-experienced that from his own perspective, feeling his adrenaline rush and his rage, but also through the eyes of the drunk man, feeling the embarrassment, the humiliation of being beaten by a teenager. He felt every one of the 32 blows of Tom's fists in his face. Now, Tom couldn't have told you before how many times he hit him, but re-experiencing it from the man's perspective, he knew there were 32. And he said he felt his nose getting bloody. He felt his teeth going through his lower lips, all through the perspective of his victim. And Tom mentioned other examples from his life where he experienced an event again in his life review through the viewpoint of other people as well.
So what's going on there? It's are they all left, not all, but are most of the experiencers then of these experiences, are they imbued with a deep sense of empathy? That seems to be a characteristic.
Yes, no question about it. They come away from this experience thinking that we are all interconnected. They say it's like if you look at your hand, if you just look at the five fingers, they seem like they're separate entities. But when you see the whole hand, you see they're all connected at the palm, and that you can't cut one without all of them being affected. And he says that's the way we are. When you come back from this near-death experience, you realize that all people, in fact, all entities in this universe are interconnected, and we're all involved with each other's fate. And basically this comes down to the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which is part of every religion we have. And they feel that for them, after this experience, they know that it's not just a guideline we're supposed to follow, but this is a law of nature. This is the way the universe works. When you help someone else, you're helping yourself as well. And when you hurt someone else, you're hurting yourself as well. And that makes them treat people differently afterwards. They see the divine in someone else as much as the divine in themselves, and they treat people with respect after this experience.
Let's talk about the biology of all of this. There's a chapter you have in the book called "The Biology of Dying," and it one of the stories you tell here is Kirsten's story. Leaving her body was a part of her. She has this seizure experience,
right,
and
it was
horrifying for her. Talk a little bit about her experience and what it is, because one of the questions you get at is if these experiences are real, then how do we explain that? And where would they be centered? In what part of the brain? And I mean, talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah. There was a lot of speculation that what causes us to feel like we're out of our bodies is something about the temporal lobe of the brain, or the junction between the temporal and the parietal part of the brain. And there were reports that people who have seizures of that part of the brain, where the brain is firing electrically with out of control, have these experiences frequently. Now, that was not from some reliable data. That was very sketchy data, but still there was that idea that this is probably what happens. So I did a study interviewing people who got admitted to our epilepsy center and looked at what they actually experienced during their seizures, and then looked at the data about what part of the brain was involved with the seizures to try to see whether there was a connection between the temporal or parietal lobes and the out-of-body or near-death experience. And what we found was that a sense of leaving the physical body was extremely rare among patients who have seizures. We did find that about 7% of these patients had at least some vague sense of not being in the body anymore. Many of them said things like, well, I just sort of lost track of my body, or, you know, I felt like I might have been separated. But there's only one patient in the 100 that we interviewed who said, frankly, I did leave my body and I could look down and see it. And that was Kirsten. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she did not have a temporal lobe seizure. Her seizure was right in the middle of her head, between left and right on the very top. And in fact, when we looked at all those 7% of patients who did have something like an out-of-body experience, they were not in any one particular part of the brain. They were all over the brain, left side, right side, different lobes. But Kirsten was the only one who felt that she actually did leave her body. The others all said, of course, that can't happen. It's just an illusion, something my brain did to me. Well, Kirsten also thought it was something that her brain did to her, but she thought it was real. That she said somehow when she had these seizures, her brain allowed her to leave her body. And she had had these experiences since she was born. Yeah. And they were terrifying for her. They were very short-lived, a minute or so. And she was very worried when she was out of her body that something would happen to her body while she was not there. And as I said, it was a terrifying experience. She never had any other parts of a near-death experience that go along with the phenomenon except just being out of the body and looking down on it. And she claimed to have been able to see things accurately from this out-of-body perspective. Now, I didn't test that, so I don't know for sure, but that's the way she experienced it. And it was not like a near-death experience in any other way, except that she had this experience of being out of the body, looking down and seeing accurately.
Mm. Let's talk about the differences between near-death experiences and mental illness. Mm.
Yeah,
A lot of people make a connection there.
Sure.
This is something you've spent a good deal of time exploring. Take us through that, if you will.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am a psychiatrist, so I think about things in psychiatric terms. And when I heard these unusual experiences that don't seem to have an explanation, I thought about the connection to mental illness.
Yeah.
So I did some studies, and one was looking at a very large sample of people who had near-death experiences. And I looked at whether they had symptoms of any type of mental illness. And I found that the incidence of mental illness among this group of near-death experiencers was the same as it was among people who don't have NDEs, neither more nor less. I also looked at a series of people who came to our hospital seeking psychiatric help over the course of a year, some 800 people. And I had asked them also whether they had ever come close to death, and if so, what happened at that time. And I found that the incidence of near-death experiences among this sample of psychiatric patients was the same as it was among the general population, neither more nor less. But there did not seem to be any connection between NDEs and mental illness.
So you get to this question of where do they go? These people, when they leave their bodies. You say in the book, many of them have these elaborate descriptions, of course.
Right.
As you mentioned, more often than not, it's a world of bliss. 90% said it was a peaceful kind of place. And then in this section of the book, you ask, is that what people through the ages have meant when they described heaven? You know, because some believe this is heaven. That's where I'm going. But talk about this, because most, you said that didn't say it was unfamiliar, but it was another dimension. And you say half of the experiencers in your research couldn't describe a place that they had gone, and the other half who did weren't really terribly consistent. So where are they going? How do they explain where they're going? Because this clearly comes up for some, at least conventional sort of believers, that maybe it's heaven.
Right. Well, most near-death experiences, when you ask them to tell you about the experience, say, I can't. There are no words for it. It can't be described in language.
That was a big theme in the book, it seems.
Yes.
It's hard to explain, yeah.
Very common. And then, of course, we researchers say, great, tell me about it. Right. And, of course, they can't. So we force them to distort the experience. And they usually do that by using metaphors to describe something close to what happened to them. Hmm. And most of our metaphors are from cultural or religious backgrounds. So your background will determine how you describe the experience to someone else. So, for example, people all over the world will describe encountering this warm, loving being of light. And if you happen to live in a Christian community, you're likely to say this was God or this was Christ. If you happen to live in a Buddhist or a Hindu culture, you don't use those words, but describe the same phenomenon.
Right.
So how we think about and describe these experiences to other people is determined in part by our cultural and our religious backgrounds.
Let's talk about this question of what near-death experiences reveal about God or ideas of God, how something divine could come through in these experiences. You say in the book, almost 90% of near-death experiencers say they encountered some kind of divine or godlike being.
Right.
But you write about the difficulty in this. How do you test something like that? How do you measure or test the accuracy of those kinds of accounts? What do you make of that?
Right. Well, we don't know how to test the accuracy of a statement about God.
Yeah.
But what we can do is look at the consistency among different reports from people of different cultures. And we certainly have lots of reports from different cultures today and from cultures going back to pre-Christian times. And what people report consistently is the sense of something greater than themselves, something larger than us themselves that's more powerful, more knowing. And when they describe this, they often will say, to me at least, I'm going to call this God so you know roughly what I'm talking about. But it wasn't the God I was taught about in church. This is much bigger than that. And some say, well, you know, the word God is too puny to describe what I experienced. But they report it as something that is larger than themselves, something that they are a part of, and that they participate in the same type of divinity that this other being is part of. And some use the analogy of a wave in the ocean, and they say that an individual person is like a wave. Mm. For a while, at least, you're distinct from the rest of the ocean. You have your own form, but you're made of the same material as the rest of the ocean is. And at some point, you're going to fade back into the ocean and not be identifiable as an individual wave anymore. But you're all part of the same thing. And they say that we are that same type of divinity that this other being was. But for some reason that we don't really know, you are separated for this time and incorporated into this body. And when I try to ask them, you know, why do you think that is? They give me different answers. So I don't think we know what the answer is.
Yeah. One thing that's really important to say about all of this, and this seems like a main – in fact, you say in the book that if people take only one thing from the book, you want them to appreciate what you describe as the transformative power of these experiences to change people's lives. Not only does it change their attitudes – does it change their perceptions? But it changes their behaviors as well.
Right. Yes. Yeah. You see this most vividly in people who had some type of a violent profession beforehand. For example, career police officers or military officers or people who were involved in organized crime. And after a near-death experience, they totally reject that lifestyle. They feel like even though I felt it was important to have policemen out there, you know, maintaining order in the community, I myself could no longer shoot somebody, even if it was in self-defense. I can't do that anymore. And they often come back convinced that they need to change professions, and they go into some, usually a helping profession, healthcare, social work, clergy, teaching, and so forth. And I've also spoken to people who were in cutthroat businesses where they came back from a near-death experience thinking that getting ahead at someone else's expense no longer makes any sense to them since we're all in this together. And they either change how they did their business treating people much more compassionately, their competitors, their customers, and so forth, or getting out of that business entirely and going to some, again, a helping profession. So it does dramatically change people's lives, which is not always easy for them. Sometimes families have a hard time dealing with this change. I've seen marriages break up because of this. Yeah. And I've seen children have a hard time with their parents having a near-death experience and suddenly being as if they're different people.
So you think it's possible that what is going on is that NDEs could possibly be triggered by electrical or chemical changes in the brain that, as you say in the book, permit the mind to experience separating from the body at the moment of the death. So that's possible. But that I have to say that still doesn't explain how Holly saw the spaghetti sauce stain on your tie.
No, it doesn't. And I don't have a good explanation.
Yeah.
But these things do happen. We have many, many examples. Some of them are very rigorously investigated. Some are not. And we just don't have an explanation for them right now. It's hard to imagine how we will ever have a materialistic explanation for them.
Yeah.
But I can't say that we never will. There are some people who insist doggedly that we may not understand it now, but someday when we understand enough about the brain's physiology, we'll be able to explain all this material by just a physiological explanation. Well, that's a plausible philosophical position. Mm-hmm. It's not a scientific position, because a scientific hypothesis has to be at least potentially disprovable.
Yeah.
And if you say, well, someday in the future we'll understand it, that can never be disproven. So it's not a scientific statement. It's a philosophical position. And as I said, it's a legitimate one, and it may be right, but it's not a scientific position.
Mm. You say in the book that you've come to accept we don't have all the answers. That must have been hard, being that you were raised the way you were. And in the book, you tell about this experience you had a few years ago. You were lying down. You weren't asleep. You were somewhere in between sleep and being awake and really relaxed. But I think the experience is worth maybe you talking about, if you would, because it seems to be instructive here.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I was lying in my bed, very relaxed, and I felt as if my body was expanding. And it got larger and larger and larger. And it felt like I was going out into the universe among the stars. And I realized that it wasn't that my body parts were getting larger. They were not. But it was less that the molecules in my body were getting farther and farther apart from each other. And that was why I was expanding. So the space between my molecules was getting bigger. And I had a previous experience of that decades earlier, which was terrifying for me. I felt I was losing my integrity, and I wanted to desperately get back together again. And when this happened just a few years ago, it was not terrifying at all. It was kind of a blissful experience. I was enjoying it. And I think the difference, well, of course, I was older, and that may be part of the difference. But I think also the difference was that I was more comfortable with the idea that there are things that happen in our lives that we don't have explanations for, and that's fine. That the universe is basically a friendly place, as Einstein himself said, and that we don't have to be afraid when we don't know the answers. And that was a real change for me, growing up in a family where you could always potentially find answers by collecting more data. And now I'm convinced that we're not going to have all the answers, probably because we're not asking the right questions. For example, when you ask, where is this non-physical mind that's not in the brain? Well, I don't think we're ever going to have an answer to that, because I don't think there is a where to it. I think that's the wrong question to ask.
Let me ask you finally, one of the things you say in the book is that a lot of the attention for these near-death experiences, and I think it was reflected in a lot of my questions, frankly, is like, what do they tell us about life after death? What do we know about that part? But you say they also offer lessons about life before death. And you're hoping, it seems like the conversation kind of shifts from that focus on what happens after to what happens now, I guess.
Right. Well, this comes, I think, partly from my own bias as a psychiatrist. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a religious scholar. I'm concerned with helping people make changes in their lives. That's what I do for my living. But I think this also reflects what near-death experiencers say, that the NDE is not ultimately about death, but about life and what makes life meaningful and purposeful. And what they experienced in going through this death process and coming back was a perception of what's meaningful and fulfilling about life. And again, they come back with the idea that it's interconnection with other people, the way we feel about other people, the experiencing love with other people. And I think that's the main thing that people learn from their near-death experience, that you can say we are here to love, but certainly I don't want to put a teleological emphasis on it, but living our lives as lives of love is what makes them ultimately more meaningful and more fulfilling for all of us.
Bruce Grayson, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Doug, for this opportunity to talk.
Bruce Grayson, he's a professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral medicine at the University of Virginia. His book is called After: A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan, the program produced by Carrie Watson, by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.